items is not really illegal, it's just immoral. And wealth is apparently quite a safeguard against moral failings. So thinking about that history, and then thinking about, you know, why do we want to even consider the notion of decolonizing as a concept when we engage with museum culture? Okay, Catherine, that's not a question. So one of the things that I share with students often is a way of thinking about indigeneity and and why you might want to take a decolonizing perspective. So there's this diagram called the Peoplehood Matrix, and it's all over. The PowerPoint has a link to the article that talks about it, and it's a diagram. It's like two Venn diagrams. I can't do this on top of each other. Like, so four circles. Okay, and in indigenous culture, at least in North America, four is really the base number, right? So in the Aristotelian Greco-Roman world, it's 1-3, beginning, middle, end, you know, the three bears, all of that. It's the Trinity, it's a three-based kind of symbolic culture. Whereas here, in this world, it's four-based, so you have the four directions, and sometimes six, because up and down also count. And often, communities are bounded by four sacred mountains, right, and four sacred elements, and so on and so forth. So the Peoplehood Matrix has four things: language, place, sacred history, and ceremony. And all of those intersect, right? That's what Venn diagrams are all about, right? All of those four things intersect. So language, place, you can't have one without the other in a way, right? Language exists to define place, and place is defined in language. It's like we were talking about with Jesus yesterday at lunch. He was saying that Tamana'atan children can't learn their language, their indigenous language, without knowing Spanish, because there's so much Spanish in that's transliterated into the Atam language. So English to Atam is really hard, but English to Spanish to Atam is a lot easier. And the place names are one of the ways that you do that, right? And a lot of the language recapture or preservation activities in indigenous communities are all about nouns. They're about place names. They're about plants, animals. Don't worry about the verbs, right? Learn the key words of your culture. Everybody has running and jumping and swimming, or maybe not swimming. Running and jumping and eating and pooping and all of the things that little kids do, right? Every culture has those verbs, but the nouns are so culturally specific, and the language is anchored in the landscape, or at least in the place,
right?
And the place is anchored in the language. You know, it's symbiotic, I guess. And therefore, sacred history, because sacred history is codified and communicated through language, right? It's oral. Therefore, it's another part of this formula, yeah. And then ceremony is the embodied action of that sacred history, which is revived, right, every time, revived every time there is a ceremony, right? The sacred history comes back into reality and into living existence through the mechanism, if you will, of the ceremony. And the ceremony has language, and the ceremony takes place in a place. So you see how those four elements work together. I'll just, no, I'll save it. One more slide for it. Okay, so a few just terms. When we're thinking again about shifting our point of view, I guess. So again, I mentioned I'm a film historian, and a lot of film analysis and film history, the first question we teach students is, where do you put the camera? Right? If you're going, and this is true for still photography too, but if you're analyzing your film, you want to think about why did they put the camera there and have the action move like that, right? So positionality is really important. If we're shifting positionality to view artifacts, landscapes, ceremonies, any of those language, any of those things from a non-Western, non-linear, non-Greco-Roman influenced perspective, where do we put the camera, right? Where do we put our eyes? And so sometimes we have to, I'm not suggesting any kind of masquerading or trying to be native or act like a native. I'm just saying, you know, how do you shift where you stand, your positionality, so that you view things apart from, or attempt to view things apart from the structure that higher education and sort of modern industrial education has ingrained in us, right? And that takes some doing, that takes some thinking and mindfulness to shift that perspective. So I just want to do a little talking about terminology because language really does matter. So one term to be mindful of is sovereignty. And sovereignty has a really easy definition. The inherent human right to self-determination. Okay, I'll say that again. The inherent human right to self-determination. That's one of the questions we always ask master's students in American studies. Define sovereignty. It's seven words. You do it, right? And so it's kind of a mantra. The inherent human right to self-determination. Remember that Native nations are sovereign nations. They are governmentally sovereign, right? Treaty to treaty, government to government. So sovereignty is a concept that's really important when we're thinking about all kinds of things, not just land use and mineral rights, but also image sovereignty. And that's a lot of what I deal with in my teaching life and also in my research life, is the concept of image sovereignty, right? Who controls those photographs? Who controls those images? And who gets to decide what is the work of art and mechanically reproduced that the rest of the world uses to understand a given culture? So in the best of all possible worlds, the people who are the culture represented in the artificial medium would be the people who decide. So image sovereignty is, are we okay there? Image sovereignty is an important concept. And it's not just still images, it's also moving images. And there are very early moving images of Native peoples in the Southwest. Edison was adamant about sending cameramen out to film ceremonies. He sent cameramen to the 1893 and 4 Chicago Columbian Exposition, which was the World's Fair in Chicago, where the Ferris wheel debuted. Actually, 130 years ago, yesterday or something, I just heard on NPR, anyway, Ferris wheel. But it was also a place that had, if you know about that particular World's Fair, it was called the White City, because all the buildings were white. And then Buffalo Bill set up his little Wild West show, which they call the Red City, kind of across the midway from the White City. That was a place that Thomas Edison sent a cameraman to capture, and I mean that literally, indigenous dances. And then those got sent all around the world. These are little tiny, 90-second films in some cases, minute and 10, just little captures. And we know that the people were performing for the camera because they look at the camera,
right?
They're not unwitting, and they're not passively captured folks. It still makes it a complicated issue, for sure. You know, were they paid? Are they identified? The answer to both of those questions is probably no. Okay, so that's sovereignty. Peoplehood, we've talked about. Peoplehood is a group identity, right? Personhood is an individual identity. And you will see both of those terms in Indigenous studies. And then there are all the long list of terms for the folks we're talking about. Indigenous, Native, Indian, NDN, which is an abbreviation that's pronounced Indian, right? Indian, right? Taking out the vowels, a little bit like taking out the vowels for Yahweh, right, in Hebrew culture. Aboriginal, First Nation, all of those terms are regionally and culturally determined, and quite often determined outside the cultural groups who are being referred to. Most commonly, Indigenous groups' names for themselves are derived from the word within their language for the people, because we are the people and everybody else is not. It is somebody else, right? And I mean, that's, I think, just a human impulse. You know, we're the ones we know, and you're not, right? And so those names come that way. And then tribal and community names, which have always been with the people, but have been, what's the right word? Boglarized, I guess, by various colonizing and settler groups that have come up with other names for the people. So a couple of texts I wanted to mention to you. Linda Tuiwai-Smith, she's Maori, from New Zealand. Decolonizing Methodologies, which was published in 1999, and just like, it was a supernova in terms of Indigenous studies. It was the first really defining study of how to decenter Western and colonial epistemologies and foreground Native ways of knowing. And one of the things she says is, what we do as we, and I'm not speaking for myself, I'm quoting her, as we Indigenous people attempt to reclaim the production of knowledge, is that we choose the margins. We've been pushed to the margins by settler colonial cultures, and we are choosing the margins, and therefore, and to go back to a film metaphor, shifting the frame, right? If they've been in the margins, they've decided, okay, now we're front and center, right? So we're choosing the margins. And the role of story is really important in this whole enterprise of decolonizing, because story is essential, again, to the peoplehood matrix, right? All of those activities that intersect and are the essence of Indigenous cultures. So, I recommend this to you. I think we have the introduction on the website, and maybe I think it's only the introduction, but it's available as an ebook, and it's available, probably used copies all over the place. and so, 10 years later, Margaret Kovac publishes Indigenous Methodologies in 2009. And the chapter from that I recommend to you is chapter 5, which is called Story as Indigenous Methodology. And whatever your particular specialization, history, language, arts, STEM, art, I know I'm missing something, ancient civilizations, any of those, I mean, how we do what we do as educators is about story, right? Ultimately, we talk to children about what we're learning, right? It's all about story. So I think that you will find this accessible and also quite familiar. She says, Margaret Kovac says, stories remind us of who we are. And who we are is essential to identity, to ontology, our theory of where we came from, and epistemology, our understanding of how we know things, right? So for indigenous cultures, you know, ontology, the sort of theory of being, is derived from emergence stories, charter myths, and even, and this might be a bit more familiar from the Judeo-Christian world in the beginning, right? That's a story. And there's, you know, in the beginning there was light, there was the word, there was God, there was the Big Bang, there was conception, there was mind, there was soul, there was badger coming up from underground and going through a log and emerging in the Grand Canyon. Those are emergent stories. All of those ontologies, epistemologies, methodologies, narratologies, if you want, this is a lot of ologies, is connected to the land. And there's a scholar at the University of Arizona who worked with the Ndebele, the Apache people, for many, many, many years, wrote a book with a beautiful, beautiful title, Wisdom. Wisdom sits in places. And the subtitle is Landscape and Language Among the Western Apache. And those two things, landscape and language, are not separable. They are the same. Okay. So I recommend that to you. It's here in the PowerPoint and linked to a Facebook line. And then, so what do we do with this in the museum context? Because that's really the applied practice that we're concerned about. So I want to just mention that we talked about the Victorian Museum and the Cabinet of Curiosities and so forth. What changed a lot of that was the passage of NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, passed in 1990, supported by President Bush, of all people. So by statute, archaeological recovery of the remains must be returned to indigenous and descendant groups. So that means Hohokam artifacts are excavated, and the closest descendant group would be the Tohono O'odham or the Acumel O'odham, and those are the folks that need to be connected with these things that are excavated. Right? There's discussion about whether, and you heard some of it on Monday, about whether there's a direct line of descent from the Hohokam to the modern O'odham. The Hohokam cremated, so they can't do the DNA swabs and so forth. But in some ways, it doesn't matter, right? They occupied the land, the indigenous folks occupying the land in the same places with many of the same practices, pit houses for summer, similar food ways, similar uses of adobe and so forth. There's at least cultural continuity, if not absolute genetic continuity, which is, again, a pre-Western compulsion. So, indigenous and descendant groups must receive those archaeological recoveries and remains. And museum holdings are also covered under NAGPRA. So that means not just when things are excavated in this moment, but also indigenous groups and communities can go to museums and say, we know you have this, and we would like it back, please. And the museums have a process for deaccessioning their holdings and returning them respectfully and religiously to the group that wants to receive them. So some of the kinds of things that have been held in museums are actual skeletons, right? Real human remains. One of the more egregious stories associated with the Smithsonian was that a number of folks from, indigenous folks from the Pacific Northwest went to DC for a particular diplomatic purpose, caught cold and died, and the bodies were delivered to the Smithsonian where they were macerated. And the skeletons were put in drawers and kept there until they were returned to their home communities in, wait for it, the 1980s. Okay, so almost 100 years later. Maybe slightly less than 100 years later. So that's the kind of thing that museums hold that need to be returned. Ceremonial objects, medicine bundles, prayer sticks, all sorts of things that you would not have seen in any of the museums we went to yesterday or today. But here's a really interesting one, which is seed corn. So in the Verde Valley, which is north of here, quite a bit north of here, up near Prescott, Arizona, there is a bioecological archive of seeds. Not like Native Seed Search, I know we've talked about this, but this is actually one working with tribes. Well, so is Native Seed Search. Anyway, there's this archive that has corn going back for, you know, generations and generations. And the Yavapai tribe used NAGPRA to get seed corn out of this particular very large freezer and take it home because corn is one of their ancestors. End of story, right? And the people cooperated with that. So I think it's really useful to tell students these kinds of narratives from its story. And story is research, is ceremony, is, you know. But it also makes them think, okay, so what if my grandparents were, caught cold and ended up in a drawer in a museum? And what if my grandparents were corn, or squash, or beans, or a particular kind of tree, right? Wouldn't we want that whatever it is, to be home with us? So, first step is NAGPRA, which is legal statute that gives groups and communities standing to request the return of their cultural items. Then, subsequent to that, was developed a series of protocols. And again, this is within museum studies, but it's relevant, I think, to the kind of work that all of us do because, again, it's a shifting of perspective. So it's called the Protocols for Native American Archival Materials. Let me just call them the protocols. And it was developed by a group of indigenous and non-indigenous archivists called the First Archivist Circle, working at Northern Arizona University. And it hosts the protocols, which are digitally available. And that too is in the PowerPoint. I'm just going to read you this bullet list of kind of the high points, I guess. It's a long document, but these are the important key points. Okay? The importance of consultation with and concurrence of tribal communities in decisions and policies. And that is the bedrock of all of this, right? The importance of consultation with and concurrence of tribal communities. So when I have students work with me, I have this project that's about repatriating mid-century educational films about indigenous people back to the communities where they're made. And the bedrock of that project is well, which we call tribe sourcing, is consult. You don't make any decisions. These aren't images of you. They aren't images of your families. They are images of the community and the families within the community. They get to decide, right? So that's what the consultation part is about. Okay, that's point one. Number two, the need to recognize and provide special treatment for culturally sensitive materials. Who says what's culturally sensitive? The members of the community. That's not a decision made at an administrative level at some institution of higher education, right? That is a decision made within the community, within their structure. If their structure doesn't match one's expectations of how those decisions should be made, tough, right? It's their decision. They get to make it. Rethinking public accessibility and use of some materials. You know, again, the community gets to decide what the outside world sees and learns about them and what is put out under the guise of, you know, institutional authority of what represents that group of people. The role of intellectual and cultural property rights. So all of you, I'm sure, in one way or another, have encountered the concept of intellectual property, right? IP, and who has, you know, your students have IP over some things, and your districts have IP, and we as scholars have intellectual property. Okay, but Indigenous people have intellectual property, and it exists as story, as material objects, as cultural practices, as the four circles of the peoplehood matrix, right? Landscape is intellectual and cultural property, right? So the notion that, you know, IP only exists for Hollywood is preposterous and something to be questioned, of course, and tested, and I think that is a useful exercise for students always to confront. And then when collecting institutions are appealed to for by Indigenous groups for access to things that they hold, the protocols say you need to consider copying, sharing, and or repatriation of certain materials. So does that mean you copy the photographs you have and give the originals back to the Indigenous communities? That's a conversation. The community may say, sure, you can keep copies for research purposes. Kids and scholars from our community may want to research these particular images later, but we're taking the originals back and we're putting them in our archive, or we're putting them in our museum, or we are putting them in our council house or our kiva, and or we're destroying them. It's up to them, right? It's their choice. And it's a privilege if the collecting institution gets to keep a copy. And it's a privilege that should really be honored, and the uses would be then prescribed by the Indigenous group. Again, consultation and conversation about how that happens. The protocols also counsel, and this is an important one, the recognition of community-based research protocols. Community-based research protocols, right? And contracts. So, you know, anthropologists know this. It's a bad idea to go into a community and just start writing about them without any engagement, you know, just observing, right? And not being a good guest and meeting people and talking to them and saying, is it okay if da 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 da? This concept that there are community-based research protocols takes that a lot further in the sense that one's anthropological training in ethnography, for example, in observation techniques, needs to sort of be set aside. And the guidance and the training and the education in that activity needs to come from the community. So everything, you know, only students go into a new community with your mouth closed and your ears open. The flip side of that is go into a new community with your mouth open and eat everything you are offered. So the mouth works two ways, right? Food in, not so much language out, right? You're not there to prescribe, you're there to learn.
Jennifer, I think someone had a question.
Oh, question? Yes, please.
Well,
yes.
I was just going to ask, like, I know it's like national law, like it has to be followed, but with all of these like guidelines that they're listing, like they're guidelines, right? Like, so at the end of the day, the collecting institution has the power to decide what all of these things like look like.
All of these things
like consultation. Mm-hmm. I mean, like yesterday we heard like, okay, like two members of each tribal nation like are consulted, but like then we heard a story about, you know, a Hopi basket that they didn't want, that they were concerned about, like, what it looked like. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, like, it was decided. Like, at the end of the day, somebody got to decide, right? Like, and consultants and people might disagree, or all of these things can happen. So, like, there's still, like, do any of these, there's laws around, like, the funeral things and burial mm-hmm. things, but, like, other items, there's not laws around, or like these are just guidelines.
I think it's an item by item issue, right? You know, the case could be made that it sounds like a cliche, and sometimes uninformed people will go, oh, well, they'll just say anything's a ceremonial object so that they can get it back. Well, prove it isn't. You know, I mean, how do you know it isn't a ceremonial object? What's your definition of ceremony, right? There are some things that you should hold in your hand when you tell stories at certain parts of the year, seasons, right? Is that a ceremonial object? Well, so at the end of the day, you're right. Publicly funded institutions are bound by NAGPRA, and good museum ethical practice is bound by the protocols. If people want to continue doing what they do, hopefully in collaboration with the indigenous groups, they're gonna follow these rules. And places get reputations really quickly if they disregard those guidelines and rules and the law.
So when we go to a publicly funded institution, like you would assume that like everything there has not been asked to be like
returned.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, can you speak to that,
yeah.
Please?